Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. If you want a sense of just how important the fight is for the 13th Congressional District, look no further than the ads in your own Facebook feed. The Rodney Davis and Betsy Dirksen-Lonergan campaigns have spent a few $100,000 already on Facebook ads, plus thousands more spent by outside groups like real estate agents, unions, healthcare advocacy groups, and national political organizations. Those ads are under the microscope in a class at Illinois State University focused on social media and elections. Ryan Denham speaks to its teacher, Nate Carpenter, the director of Convergent Media at ISU's School of Communication.
What are the issues that are being campaigned on kind of beyond the Facebook page, right? Like we're used to the idea that, oh, I can go see, you know, this person's Facebook page and it might show up in my timeline. But the ads are really the place where additional influence is exerted. And so we're able to kind of see through this ads library, like, you know, how are these candidates for office targeting select members of the population, not just those who are kind of self-seeking to go out and kind of find and follow these pages. This is, you know, groups of people that they are deliberately trying to reach out to.
So in looking at all this data, what can you tell us about who the campaigns are targeting? What kind of people?
Typically, when you buy a Facebook ad, you can say, you know, here are the age ranges I want to target. Here are the genders I want to target and the locations I want to target. And we can get a sense of kind of who the top brackets are that each campaign is trying to reach out to. We see this pretty distinct split between younger voters and older voters, right? Or at least younger and older audiences that are attempted to be reached, right? So for Davis, we see much higher proportion of the 65 and older audience, right, that kind of outcompetes Lonergan. And same for 55 to 64-year-olds, right? And there's really 2 reasons for that, at least the way I see it. Number one is right now, many of the more engaged audiences are older, especially if we look at like the 18 to even 34-year-old crowd. They are not quite as active on Facebook. I mean, they all have Facebook accounts, but they're not consuming it at the same rate that older audiences are. The second one is just like any campaigns, older audiences tend to be more reliable voters. But again, I think the noticeable difference, even looking at these younger audiences, we see that's where Lonergan is doing more work, or at least the ads are targeting younger audiences at a much higher rate than Davis. I mean, we're talking, you know, double, if not quadruple the rate in many instances.
You know, this race has attracted a lot of attention nationally. So what can you see there in the data about the different types of messages that are going out? You know, if I'm someone who lives in the district or lives in Illinois versus, you know, if I'm someone who lives out of state.
Yeah. So again, going to Davis is a really good example here. The in-state, out-of-state is pretty obvious. In-state are attack ads against Lonergan. And then they're also issues ads. For Lonergan, I think what we saw, especially out of state, were kind of the same things that we saw with Davis, where asking for donations from out of state because it's a close race. And we see a lot of connection to the site actblue.com, which is a small donations fundraiser for the Democratic Party. The local ads are similar to Davis in that they're promoting issues for Lonergan. It's been healthcare. That's been the top issue.
What more can you tell us about the Facebook ad library, which is kind of the place where you pulled all this data from?
This is a tool that's provided by Facebook, and it's something that not a lot of people know about. It didn't really get a lot of fanfare other than kind of in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal and you know, the 2016 elections where a lot of extra scrutiny was put on Facebook. This was Facebook's answer. And they said, you know, we'll make this available so you can see how political ads are being spent and used. But I think there's also kind of a dark side, too, that there's still so much that we don't know from Facebook that is kind of non-campaign related that kind of goes under the radar. And so there's kind of a false sense of knowledge here, too, that we feel like we might have everything. But there are other ways to exert influence on Facebook, whether that's through what we might call astroturfing or sock puppetry or other kind of means of disseminating disinformation or misinformation. So this tells part of the story, but not all of it.
That's Nate Carpenter from ISU School of Communication speaking with Ryan Denham. Find all of our election coverage and our voter guide at wglt.org/election.
Good evening. I'm R.C. McBride, joined by Melissa Leibert during the WGLT Fall Fund Drive. We're asking everyone who relies on NPR and WGLT for news to contribute at wglt.org.
We're more than halfway through our fund drive, but not yet halfway to our goal. Your contribution right now helps pay to keep the news coming on All Things Considered, Sound Ideas, the Leadoff Podcast, and it helps to fund a local newsroom of award-winning journalists. That local newsroom is literally just down the street from all of us, right here. We want to keep supporting the local news here in McLean County, and you can do it right now with a gift at wglt.org.
All of this amazing content is free for the entire community to access. There is no subscription fee to listen to or read our stories. And as long as WGLT is around, that will be the case. However, the key point is WGLT needs to stay around in order to deliver the content. And that only happens if you make a contribution. Please step up now at wglt.org.
The best way to show us just how much you appreciate NPR and WGLT programming and news is with a financial contribution. We love and appreciate to hear all of the amazing comments, but financial support powers all of the things you love and helps pay for them for another year. Give right now at WGLT.org.
The pandemic has created some very real financial challenges for Central Illinois residents, businesses, and organizations. And those are important sources of revenue for WGLT. The financial impact certainly extends to WGLT. And of course, we're not alone. But we're asking that you help us and keep us in mind as you're making your contributions. And the fact is, we're halfway through Fund Drive, but we're not yet halfway to our financial goal.
We need everyone's help today, right now, to reach that Fund Drive goal. Please contribute now so we can stay on the beat and you can listen to all your favorite programs like Sound Ideas this fall and winter. You can make a one-time gift or an ongoing monthly gift, whatever works for you and your budget works for us. If you've never given before, $10 a month is a budget-friendly way to get started. Give now at WGLT.org. And thanks. We appreciate it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County has been rapidly hiring more contact tracers in recent weeks. It hasn't been enough to keep up with a late summer surge in coronavirus cases. The County Health Department has hired 25 new tracers this summer and plans to bring on about 10 more. In part four of WGLT's series on contact tracing, the department's communicable disease supervisor, Melissa Graven, tells Eric Stock the recent decline in new coronavirus cases has helped somewhat.
I have heard from some staff telling me they feel like they can breathe a little bit, knowing that there's more people in house that can help. They are not seeing like 100, 200 cases reporting out every day. They're seeing the 15s and 20s so they can come into work, seeing it's a little more manageable. I don't think any of them feel like we're caught up yet. The tracers in our program are very type A kinds of people. They want to be excellent at their job and they want to get to people as soon as that result comes in, as soon as it hits our queue, our line. And, they do feel a little bit defeated, I think, because they can't get to them as fast as we want to. They're managing their expectations and managing their own need to want to be perfect and make sure every single person gets contacted as soon as possible. That is just not something we're going to change of them, which is a wonderful quality, but it does make for them to feel a lot of pressure. And it makes it very hard to turn off COVID. It makes it hard for you to relax knowing there's still so many people to call.
And they had indicated that in some cases they've had to prioritize if there is a greater risk of a wider infection, such as at a school or a nursing home, for example, they've had to take care of those first. What might the average time be now before a case investigator is able to call someone who is positive?
You know, we're still working under that prioritization. We're prioritizing cases like the K through 12s. We are prioritizing older individuals, individuals that are identified as working in congregate living facilities or people where the spread of COVID could really be detrimental to a facility or a household or a person or a population. So those individuals, as soon as we get notified, they get a call that day. So it's within 24 hours as soon as that result hits us. Now, the person might have been notified of their result 1 or 2 days ago, but by the time we get the result, those calls are happening the same day. If it's somebody not in our priority group, it might be 4 to 5 days. And in some instances, it could be longer, although we're seeing that really shrink down to being about 4 or 5 days now.
The good thing is they've already been notified that they that they have the positive test, but that does limit your potential to reach others in in a timely manner. So that's the challenge of it.
It is.
And is there a point where a virus has spread in a community to such a degree that contact tracing becomes such an uphill battle that it becomes futile? Have we approached that point, or could we potentially approach that point?
So yeah, absolutely. Contact tracing is most effective in the acceleration phase of an epidemic, meaning you are still able to get on cases and rapidly identify them and make contact with them and their contacts and quarantine their contacts. There's been a lot of things kind of working against us for that, namely being testing and the turnaround of testing. If it takes 5 or 6 days to get your test result and then another 1 or 2 days to get to us, we're already kind of behind on it anyway. We're getting you towards the end of your quarantine. But yes, there is an instance in which it is so prevalent in the community that contact tracing doesn't work. And that's when you start seeing mitigation efforts coming in. Although we did see a spike, I don't know that I'm ready to give up on contact tracing yet in our community because we are starting to see it come down. We saw a surge, but I still think we're at a point where contact tracing can be effective if we can get to it quick enough and people can give us the information.
That's Melissa Graven from the McLean County Health Department with Eric Stock. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A $750,000 federal grant will expand anti-trafficking efforts in 46 central Illinois counties, including McLean. The Illinois State Police coordinate law enforcement efforts, while the Center for Prevention of Abuse in Peoria heads up victim service responses for the Central Illinois Human Trafficking Task Force. Tim Shelley talks with the center's executive director, Carol Myrna, and Sarah Seafried, their human trafficking department director, about what the expansion means.
This is going to allow us to serve a greater population, a larger population, and bring vital client services and protections that survivors of human trafficking deserve. So we are particularly excited to be able to receive this grant. We feel very fortunate, and we're looking forward to putting it into action.
Sarah, if you want to expound a little bit, what does the grant allow you to do that you couldn't do before, or how does it allow you to do it better?
You know, we opened our human trafficking division in January of 2018, and our priorities from the beginning were to build community partnerships and really strategize with key stakeholders on how we could enhance our community's capacity to provide services to this population. And so what this grant allows us to do is expand our victim service population, so be able to expand our services to survivors of both sex and labor trafficking, as well as coordinate with law enforcement and other key stakeholders to identify victims, as well as prosecute the offenders. So it really is a collaboration, a partnership through the U.S. Attorney's Office and the state police.
So does it usually start with a survivor of trafficking comes to you, says, I need help, and then you help them get involved with the police and the criminal justice process, or does it work the other way around, or a little bit of both?
Our referrals come from a variety of places, so we certainly get a lot from law enforcement, hospitals, and other medical providers, social service agencies. We get referrals from the community as well. So the goal would be there will be no wrong door for a survivor to reach out for help. And if they do reach out for help, that all of our key stakeholders within our service territory will know to call our organization to get that help started.
Can you talk a little bit maybe about some of the survivors you've already helped in the past?
Well, we've been fortunate enough to provide services to over 75 individuals within the last 2 years of opening this division. Our youngest was 11 when she was being trafficked. She was a victim of sex trafficking by a family member. Her mother provided her to a landlord for sexual services. And our oldest client came about from a referral from federal law enforcement. She was actually our oldest client at 62. And she was a victim of labor trafficking through the number one venue currently for our state, which is domestic servitude. So she was held basically as a household slave for 7 years by her employers, forced to perform domestic chores.
Has the pandemic had any kind of impact on human trafficking?
Most definitely. You know, we are receiving reports throughout the state and the country. We know that traffickers are targeting vulnerable people. So within the pandemic, individuals are experiencing an increased incidence of homelessness and poverty, and traffickers are exploiting those vulnerabilities. For our services, in the beginning of the pandemic, we certainly saw a decrease in the number of referrals that were coming to our organization. I just spoke with my case manager this morning, and we've got 3 pending referrals now. So I'm hopeful that that means that individuals are reaching out for our help and that they're finding us.
I think it's important for everyone to know that over 80% of the people that we've served for human trafficking services at the Center for Prevention of Abuse have been from Central Illinois. I say homegrown, people from right here at home. But fighting the crime of human trafficking is a whole society effort.
Carol Myrna is the executive director of the Center for Prevention and Abuse. Sarah Seafried is the human trafficking department director for the center. They spoke with Tim Shelley. 2020 has proved to be a very eventful year, and that is an understatement. You depend on NPR and WGLT to keep you informed, and we depend on you to help fund 24/7 news coverage with your financial support. Give now at WGLT.org during the Fall Fund Drive. Your contribution powers the day's top stories and live coverage like the Supreme Court Justice confirmation hearings. Contribute today and fund the news you need. Give at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University dives into the winter of our discontent in a new production of Shakespeare's Richard III. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more with the director of the play, who says now is the perfect time to explore what the play has to offer.
Illinois State University Theater moves Richard III from stage to Zoom in a new production that also transfers the action from the War of the Roses to the modern day. John Tovar is the director of the show that's opening October 30th online. He says this story is incredibly timely and, as such, is set in the current corporate environment.
So what we're thinking in terms of that is, say, for example, we have the monarchy of England that ultimately everything is centered around. What we did was we translated it into basically a corporate conglomerate, an international corporate conglomerate that is ultimately responsible for many different other factions, which are other subsidiary companies.
Now, I know this word is being overused a lot these days, but I can't help but wonder, is Richard III a narcissist?
I think it is safe to say that Richard III is a narcissist. In looking at the play, and particularly those monologues that are directed to the audience, and he talks about, I am going to play the villain, and how throughout he gets people through manipulation to do all of these different things for him, and how he prides himself ultimately on being able to get anybody to pretty much do anything that he wants. So there's definitely ego that goes in with that.
What I think is striking about Richard III, I believe it's the only one of Shakespeare's plays where the lead character, the protagonist, comes right out and immediately starts talking to the audience. There's that direct
address, and he's drawing us in, and there's this level of intimacy. He draws us in, and we actually are maybe a little amused by the way he goes about things. And then later on, you know, when the two princes get killed and that sort of thing, there's this sort of sense of horror that we were sort of suckered into it.
Absolutely right. And I think that's what's one of the great things about this particular play is that Richard addresses the audience and does what he basically does to the other characters in the play, gets the characters and gets the audience to get on his side and understanding why he's doing what he's doing and that what he's doing is ultimately right in order to better society. The audience gets roped into that manipulation right off the bat. And if the actor who's playing the role can do that in a way that the audience feels justified in siding with Richard at the start, then there is that moment in the play, like when the princes get killed, that the audience can go back and reflect and say, why did I think this was okay in the first place when it's gone to such an extreme? And now in looking at that, it allows the audience then to look at the grander scope of the world that they live in. It allows the audience again then to reflect on, why did I think that was okay? It creates a nice larger discussion, not only about the play, but then about how people are viewing things that are taking place in current society.
Let's talk about the technical aspects of the performance. Will this be recorded just once and then shown on YouTube? Will it be live streamed? How are you arranging that?
That has been the biggest challenge, which I completely love. One of the things that I went in with was that I don't want it to become your staged reading of a play where we're just watching people's faces, look at screens, and read text. So we're trying to push the envelope with that when it comes to how can we use a platform like Zoom to our advantage to create a larger world. We're going to do it as a live stream production. We broke the play up in two acts. So the first weekend will be part one, the first half of the play, and the second weekend will be part two. And we kind of looked at it as almost like a mini-series event that you would see on television. One of the reasons why we decided to do that is because Zoom fatigue for people watching things on Zoom is a very real thing. So we wanted to break it up and make it a little more palatable in that way.
That's John Tovar, director of Richard III, running in two parts, October 29th through 31st and November 5th through 7th. Tickets are free from the ISU CPA page. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Hear more about the technical challenges of mounting an online version of Richard III at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker.